Shrink Wrap Radio number 425, The Unconscious Impact of Culture on Psyche, with Jungian analyst Samuel Kimballs, PhD.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Jungian analyst Dr. Samuel Kimballs. He is a training analyst at and former president of the San Francisco C.G. Jung Institute and author of the new book, Phantom Narratives, The Unseen Contributions of Culture to Psyche. For more information about Dr. Samuel Kimballs, please see our show notes for this episode at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Sam Kimballs, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm really glad to have this chance to speak to you. It's funny, we live in more or less the same neck of the woods. You're in Santa Rosa, I'm in Rohnert Park. We're probably all of, 10 or 20 miles from each other at the most. And yet we haven't had very much contact. And for example, I didn't even know that you were... that you had been president of the San Francisco Jung Institute. So please accept my belated congratulations.
Well, thank you. And it's good to have that sort of behind me at this stage.
I was going to say, I didn't know whether to say congratulations or commiserations.
yes, a little bit of both.
I know that having that kind of responsibility can be a two-edged sword, and it's something that you write about in the book as well, and we'll double back and talk about that a bit later on. Also, I have this recollection, you know, speaking of groups, and we're going to be talking about groups, which is what your book is about. And just so that all of our readers are on track with us, our listeners, I'll just say the title right now, Phantom Narratives, The Unseen Contributions of Culture to Psyche. And I have the recollection, but I'm not sure if it's right, that you were involved in the local men's movement for a while.
Right at the very, very beginning of the men's movement group, a colleague and I, Michael Whitson, were involved in lots of years of doing what we would call male initiation weekends. And and had ongoing men's group, and I currently have a men's group and that kind of thing. So lots of work with men and men's group during the earlier phases of its development and before it became a big national kind of thing. But yes.
Okay. Yeah. I'm in a men's group actually with Larry Robinson, and I've been in a men's group. We've been in a men's group for over 20 years. So it's something interesting that we have in common.
Yes.
So let's get to your book. Again, the title is Phantom Narratives, The Unseen Contributions of Culture to Psyche. And I have to say that for a book that's only 112 pages long, that's without the index at the end and a couple other things, you've packed in a lot of very rich, thought-provoking, and at times disturbing ideas.
Yes. Well, I was somewhat surprised, too, that it could all fit into such a short, small book. But I know that so many of the ideas don't get better with a lot of elaboration. And so it's best to sort of say them straightforwardly and see if I can somehow frame the theoretical part of it and let folks begin to interact with the ideas and eventually with me. That at some point early on when I began to write about cultural complexes, it was a time when not much had been written about the unconscious at the level of the group, especially the unconscious operating at the level of culture. We had some ideas about scapegoating and projecting and that kind of a thing. But I found that after a couple of papers and a couple of workshops that a lot of this material came into people at a visceral level, and their intuition came together with the concepts, the theory, and the ideas, and it began to sort of elaborate itself or generate some elaborations that were very, very useful in my learning to think about cultural complexes. And so, yes, it's a lot packed in, a lot to unpack, and hence, I think, the kind of conversation that we will be having and are having now are very, very valuable in the unpacking phase.
Yeah, let's do some unpacking. But let's start at the end. Near the book, you have a section titled The Group Paradox. And I thought that was kind of a fascinating phrase, and that might help to frame our whole discussion. So what is the group paradox?
Well, it's an interesting term. It grows out of another term, which is that we are social animals. And I've always been sort of fascinated with the idea that the social and animal were put together as a description of human beings. And the group paradox idea, the concept of the group paradox, grew out of a kind of a deeply apperceptive sort of sense of that as human beings, we are absolutely completely interdependent.
Right.
That we work very hard on trying to find the right sort of distance between our relational needs and our need for some sort of autonomy and separateness. And that creates this strange sort of tension that's a part of all groupings. What to do with the individuality and what to do with the reality that there is a group and that something in me is trying to find some sort of relationship with the group and or avoid certain kinds of relationship with the group. But at any rate, it generates a kind of anxiety, which later on, early on in the book, gets expressed by Bion in the form of what he calls basic assumption, which is an idea that says essentially that there's a certain kind of anxiety that we begin to experience and respond to in groups. The group is a great unknown, and it is capable of accommodating all kinds of projections and all kinds of feelings. And because of that, it's easy to feel sort of lost or unrelated or unsure. And so the group paradox is an attempt to sort of frame that tension between the need for autonomy and individuality and the need for relatedness. And so that's one part of the group paradox. The other one is a little bit more difficult to explain, but it's essentially it's that because we, like fish in water, live in groups all the time, groups become essentially invisible to us. We can forget that we're in a group, and often we begin to think that the group is outside of us, which is both true and untrue. The group is intimately related to how we perceive, how we think, how we respond. And that sort of a part of the paradox is also in that concept of the group paradox. I'll give you a little funny thing. I think there was a group called The Who. A number of years ago, I did a video, and in the little video, there were a room full of young people, maybe let's say several hundred, and they were all dressed the same, black leather jackets or something like that, and denim jeans, and they were jumping up and down to a beat that says, "We are individuals, we are individuals."
Right.
Yeah. So that paradox is a part of the group paradox, that groups can be invisible, even as they are intimately connected with how we experience ourselves and how we experience our relationship to the group as perceived externally.
Well, just in what you've said here, it really captures a lot about my own life, because I guess like many people, my life has been spent in groups of various sorts, and I've certainly experienced the anxiety that you referred to, and maybe there'll be chances to get into that as we go along. The underlying theme that runs through the book is that in addition to a personal unconscious that we know from Freud and a collective unconscious that we know from Jung, we're also influenced by a group unconscious, according to the groups with which we are affiliated, whether they be national, racial, sexual, political, and so on. Do I have that right?
That's correct. As you know, you mentioned the concept of the collective unconscious was one that Jung was to use a fair amount and became the signature concept for his analytical psychology. Personal unconscious was the one that both Jung and Freud worked on very early in their careers. But at any rate, it was connected to the unconscious of the individual. Sometimes it got referred to as unconscious in the family system, that kind of a thing. But what was missing from both the conceptualizations of the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious was something that later was to be identified by Joseph Henderson, a Jungian analyst in San Francisco, which he called the cultural unconscious. And he was interested in trying to make room for what he saw as the activity of the unconscious at the level of the group, specifically at the level of the culture, which had its own kind of connection, both to the archetypal layer of the psyche as well as the personal layer of the psyche. But it would help, he thought, to explain a lot what was happening in culture and also in the level of the group. And so I essentially used Henderson's cultural unconscious, that concept of the cultural unconscious, which he defines as an area of kind of a living historical area between the collective unconscious and the personal unconscious, which was very useful for me. And what I was to add to that particular concept was the idea or the concept of the cultural cultural complexes. And what that was... that was my attempt to provide a certain kind of dynamism to the concept of the cultural unconscious, because as Dr. Henderson had defined it, it was fairly static. But it was clear to me that if there's a complex at the level of persons and individuals, there has to be a complex at the level of the group. And so why not link Jung's idea of the complex, which are these activated associations in the psyche, why not connect the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious through the cultural unconscious by using the concept of a cultural complex?
Okay, well, that raises a number of issues. Now, when I think of a complex, I think of a group of emotional charges, if you will, surrounding perhaps a wound or a trauma, and that also there may be an archetypal component. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about that. Does that sort of get at what you're talking about when you talk about the complexes in relation to the group unconscious?
Yes. Maybe later on we can talk just a little bit about Behan's contribution to the idea of the unconscious at the level of the group.
Yeah, good.
But cultural complexes are like personal complexes, do have their dynamic system of relationship that exists at the level of the group. In other words, when we think about a group, even though it may seem amorphous and vague and in some ways scary, the concept of cultural complexes says in effect that there are a system of relationships that are being structured at the level of the group. At the individual level, around the need to belong and to have an identity. And if you look at any particular group, you begin to see that every group has some sort of sense of itself, and there are expectations, there are rules, and there are fears, and there are things that belong in the group and identities that the group sort of holds, and things that belong outside of the group. And these all impose constraints on perceptions and that kind of a thing. So the idea of the cultural complex is that there are forces that move towards structuring the activity of the unconscious at the level of the group that makes sure, one, that the group has some sense of cohesiveness and some sense of continuity. It acts as a kind of a container for individuals to find their own sort of sense of belonging and to get some sort of a sense of identity. It defines what's safe and what's unsafe and those sorts of things. So just as with personal complexes, cultural complexes are organized by and around emotions and has a whole affective core, generate ways that people behave or dress or act and that sort of thing. And even though we typically think about complexes as related to traumas, that is only one aspect of a complex. When you talk about a person individually having a mother complex or a father complex, we tend to think about something that constrains the person in a way that prevents development from continuing onward in the case of a mother complex. But complexes are bivalent. That is to say, there are ways that when we talk about cultural complexes, there are ways that the issues of belonging and identity and maturing and working through traumas are all implicit in the concept of cultural complexes. And later on, if we can talk a little bit about intergenerational transmissions of traumas, I can begin to show with some examples that these complexes, when they're engaged at the individual level or at the group level, freeze up consciousness so that we can actually begin to work with the traumas or things that need to be changed or integrated as we go forward.
Okay, well, let's get personal for a moment. We kind of alternate between deep theory and some personal stuff. And you're very upfront in the book that you've been sensitized to the issues surrounding the group unconscious by virtue of your experiences as an African-American man who, as a boy, grew up in Jackson, Mississippi during a time of heightened racial conflict. So maybe you can tell us a bit about the impact of those early experiences on your subsequent career and your notions about the group unconscious that you've just been taking us through.
Yeah, that's a very good place to start. I was very conscious in putting the book together and writing the book that I needed to make it personal at some level that the readers and those who were trying to think along with me around cultural complexes could sort of have a scaffolding for or a frame of reference for. But I can remember that a lot of my early socialization around race and racial differences in the South, especially in the Black community, was around the adults in the community really taking pains to make sure that that I and my siblings and friends had some sense that there was an us and a them, and that the them were not positively necessarily inclined towards supporting how you thought about yourself as a person, especially as a African American child or a Black child, and that they were very much interested in, that is my community and family, very much interested in making sure that that the reliance on feedback was tempered in a way that that I really learned to do a kind of double think in terms of where was the feedback coming from, and if these were people, white people, there were ways that you needed to take the feedback, and these were Black people, the ways you can sort of take it in, but you certainly would not want to put your sense of self in the hands of those other people. So I didn't quite understand much of that until I was a bit older, and I could see that what they were talking about was racism and stereotyping and how damaging that could be to a child's sense of him or herself. And they were aiming to protect me from that. Now, it also helped me to see that there was a group, and there were two groups in this particular case. And they both had a relationship to a set of values and beliefs. And some of those values and beliefs were dangerous to me as a young person. So I learned very early that groups have unconscious dimension, that they could be very dangerous, and there was an in-group and out-group. I learned very early to watch for projections. I understood stereotyping very, very early. And I began to live with a certain kind of an imaginal understanding of all of that. And as I grew older, I began to gather all kinds of experiences that helped me to see that what I was dealing with and what we were dealing with as a collective were these very old and ancient kinds of problems that had to do with, in this case, racial differences. So that was my early understanding of groups and differences. And I didn't have the term complexes, of course, until much later. And jump ahead to another phase of my life where these issues join with my psychological understanding. And this happened, and I think I refer to this in the book, where at one point I had applied to become a member of a candidate at the San Francisco Jung Institute. And part of that application involves an interview with an admissions committee, where they ask all kinds of questions and try to get a sense of where I'm at and so forth and so on. At any rate, the evening before the interview, I had this dream. And the dream was that I was had gone to a Black Muslim mosque, and I went in for a moment. I sat down and I saw that the mosque had all these Black men in the mosque, and they were dressed in suits, and some sort of ceremony was going on there. And then I heard a voice that says, "Your interview is time for your interview," and I got up to leave. And to go to the interview, and the door at that point was barred by several men who said they would not let me pass unless I demonstrated a secret handshake. And that handshake would let them know that, first of all, I knew the handshake, but that I would remember them as I go through this next phase of my journey. Now, that dream stood with me for a lot of reasons, but the part of it that's relevant to what I'm now talking about is that it showed me that the unconscious at the level of the group, I had no connection with Black Muslim men at that particular time, and had not joined whatever was going on at the dream level with the Jung Institute. But what the dream showed me was that there was something, some sort of activity coming from the level of the unconscious, not just my personal unconscious, because these were Black men who stood for the Black consciousness in the Black community. So not just from my personal unconscious, but also from the unconscious of the group. And the group unconscious, as expressed through these men, were saying to me, "Look, you are going into a different cultural setting in which the issues and the areas you will be focusing on has a lot to do with who you are as a person, and you best not to forget where you come from. Otherwise, you know, if I were to read the story before, but otherwise you would be lost." So it was my first understanding that there was a group unconscious, and it did make claims on me. And as I got further into it, the group unconscious makes claim on everybody, especially as regards to race, class, gender, ethnicity, those sorts of things.
Right, right. That's a sort of classically archetypal dream in terms of having to pass through the gate, standing before judgment, and even crossing the threshold.
And initiation.
Yes.
Because oftentimes the analytic training, and especially in the Jungian world, is seen in terms of initiation, the initiation archetype. And so my psyche must have perceived and known that, that if you're going to be initiated into something, you're actually having to face some very essential aspects of who you are as a person, who you belong and who you belong to and what you belong to.
Well, particularly too, entering into the Jungian world is, I think, a very white world. I mean, it's really, in some ways, the epitome of a white world intellectually.
Yes, it is and has been, and you know, and I think to sort of dream that earlier dream forward, at some sort of level, my psyche must have known that, not that it was just a white world, but the theoretical structure, the emphasis, for instance, on the individual, the emphasis mm-hmm. upon the inner, the emphasis upon the psyche as within the individual, mm-hmm. leaves out the cultural orientation. And whatever else the psyche means to people of color or people in other ethnic kinds of group, the group is very important. And the psyche is not just within one's ears. It's not just inside. It's also a living spirit that has something to do with the connection we feel both horizontally and vertically, and also historically with our ancestors, our people.
Yes. Yeah. I definitely got that as I was reading your book. Now, on page 5 of your book, you go through 5 basic ideas underlying cultural complexes. And I think it might be worthwhile to have you take us through those or even read those 5 things from the book, because they really help to set up everything else that we might talk about.
Yes, I'll read these, and then I can read something from the beginning of the book, which may help to sort of get more connected with the idea of cultural complexes. Anyway, these were 5 earlier components of cultural complexes, which I have sort of elaborated on in other form, but they are the skeletal part of the theory. So the 5s are, the first one is that cultural complexes operate through the group's expectations, its definition of itself, its destiny, and its sense of its uniqueness. They operate through the group's fears, its enemies, and its attitude toward other groups.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense.
Secondly, cultural complexes are a dynamic system of relations that serve the basic needs for belonging and identity through linking personal experiences and group expectations, as these are mediated by ethnicity, race, religion, and gender processes. That essentially, the cultural complex is a way to talk about the energy involved in linking personal experiences with these larger group identifications, racial, ethnicity, religion, gender processes, etc.
Okay.
Cultural complexes impose constraints on the perceptions of differences or accentuate them, emphasize identification with the group or differentiation from the group. So to get back to the group paradox, once again, that would be sort of an elaboration or statement about that, accentuating differences and working toward the belonging and connecting. Fourth, cultural complexes allow us to relate psychologically to cultural factors that operate beyond the individual but intersect with the individual's sense of him or herself. And then the final one is that cultural complexes are the psyche's way of narrating its relationship to the group. So that last one, one would have to understand a little bit of Jungian theory to get that when it said the psyche's way of narrating its relationship to the group, the term that's not stated in that little sentence is the Jung's term of the autonomy. The psyche, in Jung's sense of the term, functions autonomously. It is the part of the, it's sort of like the immune system. It has its own reactions to what is being picked up or experienced or taken in or dealt with by the individual and or the group. So it generates its own kind of relationship with all of that. So later on, if we mention the term phantom, I use the term phantom narrative as a way to sort of give an image to how the psyche is representing its narration of any individual relationship to the group or the group relationship to the individual, how the group is active in the life of an individual. So those are pretty skeletal kinds of comments that was taken to just give a little bit of introduction to cultural complexes. But I'd like to read just a little bit, a piece of the epigraph, because it's an example that I thought was, it sort of fleshed out in another sort of way the how cultural complexes are implicit in the life and activities, in this case of an individual. But I think it may help if you're open to that.
Yeah, before you do, let me just comment in passing, because we haven't explicitly said this, is that these tools that you're working with, the idea of phantom narratives and cultural complexes and these group dynamics that we're talking about, are really tools or lenses that can be applied to looking at lots of very troubling group phenomena in our world, such as racism, such as genderism, such as terrorism, youth gangs, and on and on, right? So
correct.
I think it's important to take note of that. So with that, why don't you transition into
the that's good. Thank you for just a reminder of that. These are not theoretical ideas. So much of these ideas and concepts are used fairly often in my consultation work with groups and in trainings that have to do with culture and cultural complexes. But this is a little story I'm about to read. It's part of the epigraph, but it's a very, very interesting story that came out last year in a little journal, magazine in Germany in November 2013. And it involves this 80-year-old man who was found to have in his apartment over 1,000 works of art. The reality that these art pieces were in this man's possession came about because he was stopped on his way to, I think he was going from his apartment in Germany to some place in Switzerland, and he was stopped for some reason and found to have a large amount of money. And in inquiring about where the money came from, they ended up looking at his apartment and found these 1,000 works of art, and they took them, art like from Max Liebermann and Marc Chagall and Franz Marc and Pablo Picasso, Matisse, and so forth and so on. And it turns out that this man's father, Hildebrand, was an art critic and museum director, and had died in 1956. And this man, Cornelius Gerlitz, had taken over the art and had put them in his apartment. And for decades, he would pack and unpack the artwork each evening to admire them.
Now, this art was actually, at least some of it, or a major portion of it, was stolen from the Jews. Is that right?
Well, that's what eventually became the concern of the authorities, that they thought it was stolen. But the father thought he was protecting the art from the destruction by the Nazis.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So this man, and Gerlitz, would each evening speak to the paintings. They were his friends. They were loyal companions. They didn't exist in his real life. He considered it his life's mission to protect his father's treasures. And over the decades, he lost touch with reality.
That almost sounds like a myth.
It does sound like a myth. He didn't understand why people were after him, why they wanted the artwork. He was just doing a good thing. To protect these paintings and so forth and so on. So essentially, I say in the little commentary to that little story that this man had become a phantom. He had become a phantom in the sense that he had given up his life. There was no particular life that was left over. And it's not just his isolation. That would be one way to become a kind of a ghost to yourself. But a phantom in the sense that his identification were with cultural artifacts, art, that had in the background his loyalty to his father, and had in the background of that the whole Nazi Jewish relationship prior to the Second World War. So when you begin to put all that together, the story that one would have to tell to reconstitute a self, in this case, this particular man, would involve looking at the not just the personal, his personal relationship with his father, but the cultural context out of which the art became in the possession of the father, and the cultural context that involved the generation of this, that were involved in the coming of the Second World War, and so forth and so on. So you can see that a cultural complex is in the background of this very personal and tragic little story of this man's life. And to unpack the story, one would have to, I would say, follow a phantom narrative, which is what are the images that seem to be operating around which this story coalesce.
Mm-hmm. And later on in the book, you talk about how archetypes play into the cultural unconscious, and you go on to talk about Carl Jung's writings that explore the impact of Teutonic mythology on the German unconscious just prior to and during the Second World War. And so that's kind of some of the larger context, I guess, for the story that you're telling us. Maybe you can comment a bit about that.
Yes. Well, Jung has had a very ambivalent, troubled relationship with the rise of Nazism. He was interested, as you know, in the archetypal underpinnings of the changes in the German culture during the early 1930s, and took an archetypal perspective around the unrest and the turmoil and the agitation that was in the German culture at that particular time, and the rise of the charismatic leader that is Hitler, and was to, at some point, to compare the activities and the changes and the turmoil and tumult in the German culture to the phenomenology of the Teutonic god Wotan. And he said, if you just look at the phenomenology that's used to describe the storm god Wotan, he's a berserker, he activates things, stirs things up, he's a thunder god. So many things that has to do with unrest and instability. So he wrote, he was to write a paper about Wotan. And later on, not just Jews, but others would say he was a Nazi sympathizer, because if he were to really write about what was going on, he would be writing about the cultural, the economic condition, the social condition, or in this case, the prejudice or the scapegoating, all those sorts of things that have to do with paying attention to the cultural context. But since he did not, he was accused of being a Nazi sympathizer, and an enormous amount of confusion was to get generated around where his position was. But later on, he did try to clean that up a bit, and he does two or three essays in which he addresses the issue of Germany and its sort of sociopathic culture at the time. And later on, some of these social issues he makes some sort of reference to. But it's a wonderful little history of how one could get seduced by large archetypal mythological themes and miss the cultural psyche, and in the process miss the people who are actually suffering for real, concrete, economic, political, cultural reasons.
Yeah, you know, earlier you mentioned transgenerational, and you found that the group unconscious may carry burdens, traumas, and prejudices that are transgenerational. Maybe you can give us some examples of that.
Well, actually, if you were to put together just the little story about Gertlith and the man who's connected with the artwork and so forth, and whose father was the in the background of that story and its connection with the cultural political Germany at that time. That's a kind of intergenerational traumatic story. But maybe an interesting sort of follow-up, just to stay with that story of the intergenerational trauma and as it relates to the Second World War and the Holocaust, because we started talking about Jung and the Germans and the Teutonic God and then the Second World War and the Holocaust. Well, the story is a very interesting one as it goes forward, and I do make some reference to the French psychoanalysts Abraham and Torok, who were French psychoanalysts who were to write about a certain phenomena that they had begun to notice. And the phenomena was that they saw patients who showed all the signs and symptoms that we typically find of people with anxiety disorders or depressive processes or other kinds of psychological problems. But when they looked at the background of these patients, they were not typical backgrounds. They couldn't find family traumas or neglect or abuse or those sorts of things that may be in the background of folks who would demonstrate the signs and symptoms that I just referred to. But what they did find was that these particular patients all would have had, for the most part, a grandparents, either third generation patients from the Holocaust, grandparents or relatives who were either killed or directly related to the Holocaust. And the first generation of folks after the Holocaust had made a particular attempt to not pass on the trauma that they had experienced through the loss of their parent or relatives.
Yes.
And so what began to happen is that you have these family settings in which the impact or the import of something that happened in the past, two generations past, was being transmitted in the silence or in the gaps. So to make it a little bit more concrete, I remember I was invited to go to a conference in Cyprus, and a friend said to me, "Well, why don't you meet with so-and-so? I think you would enjoy it," because he was in the State Department in Cyprus, and he knows a lot about Cyprus. I said, "Okay, great, wonderful." So I sat down with him, and the man looked at me and said, "Why are you going to Cyprus?" And I said, "Well, there's a conference on the in which Jewish psychoanalysts and German psychoanalysts were going to get together and talk about the silence between the two groups." And this, at this moment, the man's face just got passive, and he looked away, and he said, "You know, Germany was like a page in a book. I've torn it out, and I've burned it." Mm-hmm. He said, "I would never go to Germany. I would never buy anything German," and so forth and so on. And he said, "I have two daughters." I said, "Do you talk to them about your history?" He said, "No, never." So I had a little reverie sitting at the table with him, and I thought, now what would it be like for two young girls to say, "Daddy, can you tell me about your parents? Or what about your grandparents?" And he would get silent. Well, the patient-to-be, as Abraham and Torg were to say, with these young women, when they became patients in psychoanalysis or some sort of therapy, would have feelings and experiences of some sort of something missing in their lives that may get represented as some sort of depersonalization process or some other kind of absence. And that would be a transmission of a trauma, in the generation transmission of a trauma. And working with such a trauma is a little differently done than working with a simple, these are not simple, I shouldn't say that, but a individual trauma. There are intergenerational trauma that has to do with slavery, of course, and the genocide of the Native American people. I could go on and on. There was a wonderful story in the Press Democrat a few years ago in which a group of Native American folks in Eureka, on the coast of Eureka, were the story was that they were being given some land, the same land that was taken from them, maybe, let's say, I don't remember the exact date, but let's say 100 years ago, by white settlers. And the story was that the mayor of the town, as well as the minister, were coming together with some of the current Native folks to do a ceremony to pass back the land to them. And the details of it is not so much important, that exchange, but the important thing is that how the trauma continued to structure the lives of these people. So the tribal leaders who received the land said that they were acknowledging that something had happened right at that particular spot. That was the spot that they sent out their longboats to go out into the ocean to renew the world. And it was during that particular period of time that their people were sort of slaughtered. But the elders said, you know, now that you're giving back the land, we can begin to dance and weave again. We hadn't danced or sing since that time.
Yeah. Moving along here, because I'm aware the time is getting limited, the last chapter of your book is titled Chaos and Fragmentation in Analytic Training Institutes. And I have to confess that early on, I skipped ahead to that chapter because of that title, and then later went back and filled in some of the other reading. But I was totally intrigued that you would write about chaos and fragmentation in analytic training institutes. I'm sure this impulse on my part was not coming from the noblest part of my character, but you were sort of hanging out the dirty laundry for the world to see. And so, you know, I had this curiosity. And of course, you were in both the best and the worst place to report on this, having served as president of the San Francisco Jung Institute. Was this hard for you to write?
I don't know about hard. It's hard to talk about in some particular ways because I have enormous amount of gratitude for my analytic training and my teachers and colleagues and the analytic enterprise as a whole. It's a wonderful contribution to the culture and, of course, to me and many folks worldwide. And but what I was trying to talk about was how the analytic enterprise itself is a cultural complex. It arose at a different earlier time in our culture when industrialization and the culture was fragmenting and families were not able to hold the center and modernism had become the catchword and all of that sort of thing. And so analysis and analytic work came in to provide some sort of containment for many, many, many individuals who were trying to find some connection to themselves and to their world in the absence of these family and cultural rituals. Well, in the process of that response, analytic institutes and training programs became pretty isolated from the culture at large, and in some ways that the kind of critical ongoing evaluation of its own rules and structures and own belief systems stopped happening except along ideological lines in terms of different kinds of theoretical approaches and understandings of psychic material. That continued to happen, but in the case of psychoanalysis proper, led to the generation loss of different kinds of psychoanalyses and also different kinds of training program. But one thing didn't change, and that was, for the most part, the analytic institutes tend to remain insular and not so actively involved with the culture. So essentially, that's what I had wanted to write about, and a reminder that there is a cultural context for analytic institution analysis proper, and that part of our unfinished project has to do with engaging with that cultural context and finding ways to think about it and use analytic understandings to give back something to the world and the culture. And so from that point of view, cultural complexes and cultural phantoms and all those sorts of ideas and concepts are ways of my small effort to provide some sort of theoretical framework that allow us as analytic-oriented practitioners to see that the world itself is, the psyche is in the world also. I think it's not just an internal thing. There was I don't know if you remember the psychologist James Hillman, who wrote a book a while ago that says that the we've had 100 years of psychoanalysis and the world is still going basically to hell in a handbasket.
Sure, and I remember that.
Yeah, so he was trying to say something similar to what I'm saying, which is that, look, the world has changed. We're in a whole different period in which boundaries are sort of blurred and people have virtual realities that they can't distinguish from real relationships and real realities, and the world has gotten smaller and more conflicted. We can't afford to be insular. The world needs what we have to offer. And one thing we have to offer is that we know something about a relationship to something called an unconscious dimension of life. And if we can add to that the unconscious dimension of group life, we can begin to offer something that may help, I think, allow many, many people to think a little bit differently about their relationship to groups and conflict and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I went a little bit different direction with that chapter. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I'm under the impression that the structure of an analytic training institute is something of a pressure cooker. And, yeah, you know, and it's hard to examine oneself, which is what analysis attempts to do for individuals, but to then turn it, I would think it'd be hard for the analytic institute to be totally self-aware, which in a way I took your chapter as a call to attempt to do that. And so I think the structure is something of a pressure cooker. And so it would not be surprising that unconscious neurotic patterns would be triggered in all the players in that community. Some of our listeners may not be familiar with the structure of analytic training, so you know you may help to clarify that. But for example, I'm under the impression that you can go through an analysis, and then as a result of the analysis, you want to become an analyst, and so you apply to an institute, and they may or may not accept you. And then if they do accept you, you go into an analysis with someone who's in that institute. And then you also have a training analyst who is supervising you as you're doing your first analyses. And then these are the same people are going to judge you as to whether or not finally you're admitted. You're paying lots of money. And at the end, they may say, oh, well, we don't think so. So I would think that would just be ripe for triggering all sorts. Okay, so for our listeners, we got dropped by Skype. But we're back on with each other again, and I had just talked about what I perceive as the possible pressure cooker nature of analytic training institutes, and wanted to get your comments about that.
I think you described the structure of the training program. There's the whole admission process in which experiences and backgrounds evaluated in terms of the person readiness for analytic training. And sometimes that includes looking at their lifetime, the phase they are in their lives and so forth. And then once admitted into the institute, it depends on the institute you're in, there are probationary period. And then the candidate meets yearly with a reviewing committee whose job it is to help the candidate to assess his or her progress. Candidates are expected to see patients and to be in consultation, or that's the equivalent of supervision, during that period of time. There are didactic classes and seminars for typically the entire 4 years. At our institute, we require the candidates to be in some sort of a group process that's done within the context of the institute, and that's the more recent requirement.
I guess I'm wanting you to respond a little bit to the idea that there are difficult emotions that have to be processed, that there's a group unconscious that needs to be worked with in institutes. That's the heart of my question.
Yeah, it is a pressure cooker. I mean, that part is for sure. But I think the only thing to say about that is that the thought is that the all the structures that are part of the institute are designed to sort of contain some of the pressures, and the structures are there to help to hold and contain the tensions or the stressors or the pressure cooker effect of the training program. That part is true. I think maybe the part that's more difficult is simply that these are all intimate relationships. So
yes,
you both have an intimate connection with folks that ultimately you become colleagues with.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a kind of deeply, from my point of view, deeply tribal quality to institute life.
Yeah, you know, one of the reasons I was so interested in your observations about the group unconscious of analytic training institutes is that I served as chair of the psychology department for 7 years at Sonoma State University. And I observed how difficult department meetings were for our group of well-meaning and psychologically sophisticated colleagues. And
yeah,
so I think there were definitely, there was a stew of unconscious issues that, and this, even as personalities changed and new personalities, some personalities left and other personalities came in, there was something in the unconscious that persisted. And something related that I've sometimes pondered about is, you know, how sometimes you'll hear about a high school is a bad high school, you know, that lots of troubled kids and they're always getting into trouble. And it doesn't matter who the particular kids are, 30 years later, that might still be, quotes, that bad high school, that there's some kind of cultural thing going on there.
Right, right. Well, I comment that once you're accepted into the institute, you're a member for life, unless, of course, something horrible happens ethically or something like that. So these are folks that you ultimately will be colleagues with and are part of a community with for the rest of your life. But I think, again, the fact that there are very intimate relationships that have hopefully been worked through enough that people can become colleagues free of some of the burdens of, it would be like being a community in which not only your family of origin is there, but your family of creation and extended family there all the time. There's some knowing of each other that comes from that sort of ongoing close kind of genetic connection that can make a certain kind of freedom difficult to express, because the group tends to pull you back into a certain kind of identity. And that part of working through being a member of an analytic community goes on for a long, long period of time. And some folks never quite get through that. It's just part of the thing you end up carrying as a consequence of your training in such a small, intimate group.
Okay. Well, you know, we've kind of used up a bunch of your precious time here, which I'm really grateful for. And there's so much more that we could talk about here. And as we wind down, I wonder if there's more that you'd like our listeners to know, or if there were some particular issues that you'd hope to clarify that you didn't get a chance to.
Well, I think we've covered an enormous amount. It's just at this stage, I think more time would mean really getting into the whole notion of phantom proper, which is a whole different extension of cultural complexes. But maybe that's for another time. I think when the readers have a chance to take a look, or listeners have a chance to take a look at the book, the concept of phantoms, which is sort of the how cultural complexes get represented in the unconscious life of the group, is the addition to cultural complexes that we have been mostly talking about. And hopefully it makes the more abstract idea of cultural complexes a little bit more accessible and more continuous with the Jungian tradition of working with the imaginal and the images.
Okay, well, Dr. Sam Kimbles, I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, David, thank you very much for having me. I have enjoyed the conversation.
Hey, Eric, it's good to have you back here again.
Yeah, great to be back.
Yeah, unfortunately, we ran into some Skype difficulties towards the end. I thought we really had the ball rolling along very well with Dr. Kimbles. And then we had a number of Skype difficulties, which hopefully we will have sort of ironed out for our listeners. But just so people know, it felt like we lost some of our energy that we had going there at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so what stands out for you in this interview?
Well, there's so much to think about with cultural complexes. And, there's so many examples a person could think of different groups of people and what elements are present there. And I guess the first thing that comes to mind are political parties. In particular, the Tea Party just popped right into my mind.
Really?
And thinking about, you know, what cultural complexes are at work there.
Yeah.
And, you know, what's operating on the individual level in groups like that or any political party.
Yeah. And, of course, it's always easy for us to see that in our, quote, enemy groups. I'm making air quotes.
Yeah.
The groups of people that we think are really off the wall and crazy and harder for us to see our own context, which is something I was trying to get at towards the end there when I was asking Dr. Kimbles about, you know, the pressure cooker atmosphere of the Analytic Institute.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, for example, if we look at the group that we're in that we share, I mean, there are a lot of things that we share, but as Americans, and there are sort of dark sides of the American character that we think, I'm assuming that you're kind of liberal as I am.
Mm-hmm.
So we have some sense of the dark history of our own culture.
Yeah, yeah, there's certainly a sense of it. I think a lot of that dark culture or dark history of our culture kind of falls back into shadow and kind of falls back into that cultural unconscious.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of repressed memories.
Yeah.
You know.
And a lot of it we're unaware of. And so, for example, he was talking about transgenerational things.
Mm.
And I think he kind of raises the idea in the book that, you know, I might like to think that, oh, well, those errors of slavery and so on were committed. I wasn't even alive then. Those were committed by other bad people. But I think somewhere in his writing was an implication that there's some bit of denial in that, that there's a, that even though it happened in the past, that we still take part somehow in the continuity of this culture and in the historicity of it and so on. I mean, it's kind of a difficult concept to grasp. And a troubling one to own. And so that might have something to do with my difficulty in articulating it very well.
Right, right. You know, before the interview, you'd mentioned that some of the stuff in the book kind of hit home with you.
Yeah. I shared with you, and I even shared with Dr. Kimbles before the interview proper started. I think I shared it with him. Said I had some bad dreams.
Mm.
After a couple of the readings that I did, I generally would do the reading just before going to bed, which in hindsight, maybe that wasn't the best thing to do. But he talks very powerfully in his writing, not so much in the interview, but in the writing. He was able to go into more detail about the real trauma that was wrought upon African Americans, the number of slaves who were shipped out of Africa, about 15 million, I think he said, which is a very large number, 10 million or so of whom survived. And then he said there was at least one black person lynched every day in this country for a long span of years. And I had never heard that statistic before either. And also something that I haven't shared with, that I didn't share with Sam, and, you know, if I did get together with him over coffee, I'd love to share some of my own history around that stuff, is I had a black stepfather who was the only father I ever knew. So I also share some of the unconscious for that group, as well as for the white group. I've got some of both. And I remember in college, I got invited by a student, by a fellow student, to go home with him. And he lived in, he lived in Rock Hill, South Carolina. And I remember the drive down there. There were two people in the front seat. I was in the back seat. I think I had been feeling a little under the weather. But I was in terror. I was in terror going to the South. Somehow I had picked up, growing up in a partly African-American community, this absolute terror of the South and the danger, how dangerous it could be. So it was as if I were a black person who was for the first time going to the South. And, you know, so I feel like there's a way in which I resonate with a lot of that history. And so as he talked about, you know, some of the really dark aspects of both the African-American experience and our own history and the German-Jewish experience too, mm-hmm. which I could, part of me can identify with as well, it triggered some, it definitely spoke to some places in my own unconscious. Mm-hmm. Had some pretty dreams that were not very typical for me. They seemed outside of my kind of regular dreaming pattern.
Wow.
Yeah. So you have to have a certain amount of courage right. to read this book, which is not to discourage listeners from doing it. Although I have to say, and it's if you look for it on Amazon, it's very expensive. So it will take a motivated person, maybe another Jungian analyst or some psychotherapist, I think, who's really into this stuff, to want to reach out and buy it. Any other thoughts as we kind of wrap up our conversation here? Anything else that kind of stood out for you or that you wondered about?
I really enjoyed hearing about the that recovered artwork in Germany.
Yeah,
and what that speaks to culturally.
Yeah.
You know, and again, I'm reminded of cultural trauma and the healing that has to take place there for a group of people to move forward.
And that whole idea of the generational, the transgenerational transmission of trauma, that even as people were, you know, kind of like a rule of the unconscious, I guess, is that anything that we try to suppress is going to pop up somewhere else. Uh-huh. So as he was talking about people in the first or second generation who did not want to pass this on to their children, somehow it gets passed on anyway. Mm. So that's something for us all to ponder.
Right, and it makes me think about the situation in the Middle East.
Yes, there's a whole conversation there that we could have, and that Dr. Kimball's, I think, would be really great to talk about. But I think this would be a good place for us to wrap it up for today between you and me. So thanks again for being here.
My pleasure.
So I'll see you again in about a week.
Sounds great.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Gloria Ullman from Adelaide in South Australia, and I just want to let you know I'm going through all of the podcasts at the moment, right from the start, as a project to make up folders for people who don't have access to the internet and who are very interested in this kind of thing. So I'm making up folders that I think are of particular interest to the people that I have in mind. There's only two or three of them, so it's not that big a deal. But it really is a labor of love, and it makes me once again deeply appreciate what a goldmine this podcast is. I'm also making my annual donation, and it's not as much as I would really like to donate, but it's as much as I can afford at the moment. I'm not sure if you're aware, but in Australia, the exchange rate with the American dollar is not very high at the moment. So for every, say, $100 that Australians spend in American dollars, it costs us $115 at the moment. It's not very good, but it has been worse. Thank you once again for your wonderful podcast. Goodbye.
Thank you, Gloria. You've been such a strong supporter, not only financially, but also as a transcriptionist and email buddy. I'd also like to thank the following listeners who have recently gone to our support page and signed up to become regular donors. My sincere thanks go out to Thomas V. Cliff, Roger Duncan, and Michelle Nakagawa, who actually has been a past supporter, but she increased her financial level of support. Hey, there's an idea. Also, I've got a new giveaway incentive idea for a new donor who will commit to $10 or more per month. It's a knit golf shirt from The Gap with Shrink Wrap Radio embroidered in red up by the left shoulder, or left breast. I think I was avoiding saying that. It is a size small, but I believe will work for either a male or female who wears size small. I originally had it made for one of my sons, but he doesn't want it. What is it they say about a prophet in his own country? You can see this shirt if you go on our site and go to the T-shirts item under the store tab. And if you decide you'd like this, be sure to include that info in your PayPal donation along with your address. I'm happy to announce that we have a new transcript on the site. It's for episode number 415, Exploring Consciousness and Health with Dr. Marilyn Schlitz. And that's thanks to Catherine Poloinas. So thank you for that, Catherine. And if any others of you out there would like to transcribe a favorite episode, do drop me a line and let me know. And please remember to patronize our authors who advertise on our site in the right-hand sidebar. The latest is Bonnie Badenoch and her book, Being a Brainwise Therapist. You can just click on the link there to get it from Amazon.com. And speaking of Amazon.com, you know there is also an Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar that you can use to order any books you wish, but not only books, but anything at Amazon. I know many of you probably use Amazon regularly to purchase all sorts of things, as we in my family do. If you'll use the search tool in our widget, it will automatically add our affiliate code, and Shrink Wrap will get a small percentage of the purchase. It's another way that you can help to support us. And then there's always our affiliate link with Audible.com if you're not already an Audible member. Regular listener Oscar in Stockholm recently suggested I interview Susan Cain, author of Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Well, it was a good suggestion. I'm not sure if I'll act on the suggestion, though, or not, but you can listen to the book and let me know what you think. You can get this audiobook for free with no obligation to continue by going to audibletrial.com/shrink.
Hi, this is Ruth Ann and Walt Amberstone, founders of the Tarot School and the Reader Studio.
And you're on the couch at Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Amberstones. It was great meeting you two at the Tarot Readers Conference in New York City last year. Now let's turn to some recent email from our listener community. First, we hear from Morgan in Norway, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I'm a longtime listener, both to Wise Counsel and Shrink Wrap Radio. Your podcasts have really inspired me, both professionally and privately. While listening, I've had this silent voice in my head saying, 'You should donate, Morgan.' But until this day, I have not pushed the donate button. I really don't know why." But today, as I listen to the latest episode and to your reflections on the email from Sven, I decided to be a contributor. I immediately knew that I had to do so. It was like an unexpected turning point. All the best, and that's from Morgan Adolfsen, clinical psychologist in Norway. And Morgan, I'm so glad you were able to overcome your resistance, maybe your unconscious resistance, and that you finally pressed that donate button. Next, we hear from Adna, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, thank you for your decision to not put the podcast behind a paywall. As a student, I likely would not be able to make the choice of subscribing for financial reasons and for the hassle that Sven mentioned, which is in no way a reflection of the quality of your work or of the special place that it has in my life. I will continue to support the podcast when I can. However, I wanted to make a suggestion to you. Something that many big podcasts do is to offer the last 6 months of episodes free and to ask for a monthly fee for the archives. A dedicated fan would be able to listen to the entire archive in 1 to 2 months, thus keeping the cost very low, but someone who might enjoy listening to 1 or 2 episodes every week would be subscribing for much longer. I think that this might be an elegant and completely reasonable compromise. You deserve to be compensated for your wonderful work without feeling like you are departing from your mission. Thank you again for the richness you have brought to my education." That's from Adna. And Adna, I have to say, first of all, that I fully intended to make scholarships available for students or other people who were in need and who wrote to me that they couldn't afford the $10 a month that I was planning to charge. And you know, a person would not be able to listen back to all the past archives in a couple of months. I mean, really, there would be like over 400 episodes to listen to. And I was planning to provide free content, just as other podcasters do, in the form of one of the current podcasts of that month, plus some of the older ones. So what I was suggesting was not too far off from what you're suggesting here. And finally, here's one more, this one from Alice in Missouri, who writes, "Dr. Dave, I only skimmed the last email, so my conscious mind missed the previous discussion about charging for the podcasts. Thank goodness you've decided against that. My subconscious must have seen the topic. A few days ago, I dreamed you had been killed in a car accident. Please drive carefully, watch for other drivers, and keep the podcast free. I'm heading to your website to make a donation now." And that's from Alice in Missouri. And Alice, thanks so much for your concern and for my health. And I'm happy to say it's been some time since I received your email, and I'm still alive, and I'm very much appreciating your donation. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. And I tested it out today because I thought, well, maybe it's broken. Nobody has left me a message in ages. I'm happy to say it's not broken. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the apps tab on our site. Thanks again to Jungian analyst Dr. Sam Kimbles for his insights on the cultural unconscious and more. My next interview will be something different. I'll be speaking with Ian Woods, a young avant-garde musician out of London whose performing name is, of all things, Psychologist. You can see how that name caught my attention. And he's also a Shrink Wrap Radio listener. This is one you won't want to miss, and I'm also going to send you a special blast this weekend with links to a couple of his amazing music videos, which will help you enjoy the interview even more if you can get to them ahead of time. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.